Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, continuing with our ongoing series, special in-depth investigative reporting on vaccines, a second opinion. Number 10, if you've been following the series. On the last program, I was offering a step-by-step challenge to the prevailing view that without vaccines, we would be placing children and adults at risk of developing the diseases that medicine is claiming that it has eradicated through vaccine programs, and that it would be irresponsible not to vaccinate. In fact, one of the last acts of President Clinton was to push for mandatory vaccine, universal coverage. Everyone, every man, woman, and child would be vaccinated. And manufacturers of these vaccines were supporting this effort. They, in turn, are owned by pharmaceutical companies, or part of pharmaceutical conglomerates, who have a great deal to benefit, but based upon the laws that have currently been written, they have very little risk. Their liability has been capped. And the government, through our taxpayer dollars, not the profits of the manufacturer, if we have a bad vaccine, we pay the damages more than the manufacturers. So it's a win-win. So the more people that are vaccinated, the better for them. What I'm going to do today is continue to show you what has not been presented. An objective, clear, and easy-to-understand analysis of what has historically been wrong with the vaccine programs, promises that have been made and assurances given us by the very best of our physicians and scientists and government agencies. And now we have the benefit of time to review. Were they accurate? Were they honest? Did they help us? Did they hurt us? Were they deceptive? That's today's program. I've had a woman on this program, Dr. Eva Sneed. Dr. Sneed was one of the very first physicians in the United States who took it upon herself to show us what was wrong with the SV40 virus, simian virus 40. No one wanted to accept her opinions or her statements, even though they were extremely well documented. I visited Dr. Sneed. I examined her evidence, and setting aside some of her editorializing, her facts were solid. She also learned a lesson in how, even if you have the truth on your side, it doesn't mean that it'll make a difference if the media and others don't want to look at it. They didn't. But if we look back, Dr. Sneed reminds us that some of the viruses that are put into vaccines are ending up in our body in dormant or incomplete states. This means they lack a certain portion of the virus to become reproducible again. Eventually, however, other viruses are inserted into the pool of the human body, which enables pieces of viruses to recombine, just as they do in a dish when a recombinant virus is being made. This is particularly true of the SV40 virus, which very effectively binds different viruses. As a result, the body generates new and unpredictable viruses that can then cause unexpected and previously unknown illnesses. Other viruses, Sneed states, appear in their complete form. She mentions the Ebola virus. She says, this is a virus commonly found in the green tree monkey. We also have a flurry of respiratory illnesses in small children called RSV. Everyone is saying that they don't know why so many children are coming down with these diseases. But it is a common contaminant of the vaccines that children get at an early age, unquote. Dr. Leonard Horowitz, co-author of Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, argues that new diseases are the result of a special virus program, cancer program, conducted between 1962 and 1974 by researchers from the National Cancer Institute, in cooperation with biological weapons developers from the Department of Defense. He asserts he has evidence supporting the thesis that scientists were purportedly investigating vaccines for the prevention of human cancers, but in actuality were also looking to create new viruses. Now here's what Horvitz claims in his own words. and he has shared some of this evidence with me in the past. We differ on many points of view, but some of this evidence, I would certainly state the evidence itself, the documentation, is accurate. The interpretation of what it means is where we would differ. Oh, and by the way, there is a new article. I won't be reporting on it today, but I will after I do a complete analysis of it, where in Australia they have found a virus so lethal, so capable of killing, that it wiped out in genetically engineered strains all the other rodent population. Now, just imagine the potential for that in the wrong hands of people who could use that as just one more potential terrorist weapon. And it looks like the terrorist weapons of the future will not be nuclear, but rather be biological, because biological, they can be put into a water supply, and depending upon the latency period or the active period, people could be drinking water, and a week later, after it has been dispersed and the terror is gone, we could end up with something in our body that science does not have an antidote for. This is not science fiction. These scenarios are being looked at very carefully now, and in part, we're responsible because we have developed the science. It's just like there are something like 9 nuclear weapons, portable nuclear weapons, that are missing out of the Russian arsenal. Well, with corruption there and bribery so easy, you can imagine that those are in the hands of people who are not friendly to us. And could you imagine what would happen now that they know that there is this doomsday virus out there that was discovered through their research and genetic engineering? And we cannot always assume then that it will be used in peaceful purposes, not when there's so many people who are malcontent and are wishing to destabilize and to attack. So anyhow, if you look at what's been discovered just this week, and then you look back at where suddenly all these exotic viruses came from and bacteria that we've never had before, illnesses that we've never had before, well, the official view is, well, there's nothing new, or it's just been there, we just haven't discovered before. How's it possible? It's not. And then we start finding out that, yes, yesterday, the Defense Department admitted there were massacres of innocent civilians in the beginning of the Korean War, and they had known about it, and they had covered it up and denied it and denied it and denied it until the evidence was overwhelming. And I would like to also look at all those news agencies that were used by the Defense Department and the CIA to discredit the Americans who came forward, who participated, and then tried to make them look as if they were liars or something was wrong with them. Let's see if we see any apologies. And by the way, also look at the testimony before the Church Committee that identified more than 1,300 members of the media that worked for or were complicit with the CIA. Those people didn't retire. And those people weren't fired, and they weren't penalized. It was just, okay, so you work for the New York Times, and you also happen to work for the CIA, and you're working on documents, and you're going to make sure that nothing hurts the government agencies. And no one says, maybe there's kind of a lack of ethics here. Can you really be an objective reporter if you're also trying to protect the interests or promote the disinformation campaigns the CIA suggests? You'd say, well, that's ridiculous. We shouldn't have people. Nothing's changed. Nobody was fired. So even when we expose something, it doesn't mean that there's going to be a raising of consciousness to correct a problem. Therein is part of the dilemma. We are taking never-before-known substances into our body, and especially in infants where there's a completely non-developed immune system, because we say without that vaccine, that child will develop that disease or has a potential for it and hurt or infect other children or themselves. And I'm asking you, consider the facts that may challenge that before you make up your mind. I have no responsibility and cannot take that responsibility to tell you to or not to vaccinate. I'm merely presenting information from which you may have a broader perspective before you make your choice. Horowitz says, what they were creating were viruses that would attack the immune system. I literally took the government's own documents that I found in the basement of Davis Library, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, an incredible book called The Special Virus Cancer Program, which had all the government's contracts, including what they did and how much they were paid. A document published in an earlier book I produced called Deadly Innocence is literally an appropriations list for the Department of Defense in 1970, wherein they requested $10 million for the development of viruses that could essentially knock out the immune system. We traced down a request that was put through from the highest position in the U.S. government. What we found, interestingly enough, was that it was the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council that informed the Department of Defense that these types of biological weapons, what they term, quote, synthetic biological agents, unquote, could be developed over 5 years for a cost of over $5 million, unquote. Now listen carefully. It was the National Academy of Science National Research Council that was informing the Department of Defense. On my next program, on Monday, I will be bringing back the veil of secrecy around the National Academy of Science, because on the one hand, those of you who are interested in stopping Codex and stopping harmonization and pulling back the truth concerning the so-called protection we have or the immunity we have from having our supplements regulated by harmonization, you'll see who actually supported the research at the National Academy of Science. And then you'll start to say, uh-huh, got an idea now why they don't want us taking the vitamins and why they're trying to say vitamin A is toxic above 10,000 units. I will also show you what my research on vitamin A at 10,000 units shows, and show that they have been extraordinarily selective in what they've chosen. And they have intentionally not presented hundreds and hundreds of studies that do not show it toxic, in fact showed highly therapeutic and beneficial in the amount of deficiency we have in the population. So virtually everything they have said can be challenged and should be. But you have to understand motive. How can so many smart people be so wrong so consistently as the National Academy of Science is? Possibly motive. So it may not be just out of innocence. There may be an intent. And you'll have a chance to see what that is on my next program. Anyhow, the CIA was running a project called MK Naomi. That was the secret biological weapons development program, which, by the way, was against the law. It was a violation of the Hague Treaty, which had banned biological research and development. In 1969, when the Department of Defense appropriations hearings were held, it was the CIA's conjecture that the Russians were going to be beating America into biological weapons unless we did something. The CIA alleged, as they have in the nuclear race, that the Russians were far ahead of the U.S., which it turns out was not true, and they knew it. They were lying again. We were the premier biological weapons developer in the world. Horowitz continues. He said, if you go back in the history, you'll learn that the CIA brought over many of Hitler's top Nazi scientists, including their top biological weapons developer, Erich Traub, in what was called Project Paperclip. The CIA was intimately interested in a variety of viruses. The Church Commission hearings noted that they were holding on to all sorts of viruses that could knock out the immune system. And documents clearly show that researchers took things like SV40 virus and essentially extracted the DNA out of it. They infused it with other types of nucleic acids like RNA from cat leukemia and chicken sarcoma, and they created a mutant, a new kind of germ, which still had a different time infecting had a difficult time infecting humans. Then they cultured these organisms in human cell cultures or in fetal tissue, which created what's called the surface membrane changes, such as in the GP120 proteins on the external envelope, allowing these new mutants to attach to the human cell membranes, be carried across the cell membranes, enter the genes of the cell, and then essentially do everything that they wanted the virus to do. Knock out the person's immune system. So, you see, when we take a look at many of the viruses and virus research today, it's not all innocent, and it's not all benevolent, and it's not all good science. Let's take a look specifically at polio now. In the 1940s and 50s, a relationship was noted between paralytic polio and the diphtheria pertussis vaccine. In April of 1950, both the Lancet and the medical officer reported that infantile paralysis followed inoculation with the diphtheria toxoid vaccine and the combined diphtheria whooping cough vaccine. Their reports revealed that paralysis occurred within a month of vaccinating the babies. In 1950, Dr. Bertram Michalski investigated the vaccine history of 340 people in Melbourne who contracted poliomyelitis during the 1949 Victorian epidemic. Dr. Michalski found that 31 of these individuals had received their diphtheria vaccine or the pertussis vaccine within 3 months of the onset of symptoms. 23 had been vaccinated 3 to 12 months before the onset, and 121 had been vaccinated over a year before symptoms began to appear. Now, why is that important? Because in the United States, we have a very, very, very short window that we will examine any adverse effects that a child is experiencing and associate it with a vaccine. Clearly, historically, they're even showing that you could be a year after you're vaccinated and then come down with the disease caused by the vaccine. So if you simply want to underreport all your figures or deny people the consequences of their actions, simply say, well, if you don't get sick within the next 2.5 minutes, don't blame the vaccine. But what if you get sick in 3.5 minutes? Well, yes, it's the vaccine, but now you can't do anything about it. These are the games that have been played and are still being played. And everyone involved knows exactly what the story is. The senators who protect the vaccine manufacturers, their aides who work behind the scenes, making sure that all the tracks are greased. In January of 1950, Drs. Hill and Knowlton reported that the results of their statistical investigation into the relationship between pertussis diphtheria vaccine and polio during a 1949 outbreak in the United Kingdom. The British Medical Journal reported their findings, quote, whichever way we choose to set out the statistics collected in this inquiry, they reveal clearly an association between recent injections, meaning vaccine, and paralysis. We must conclude, therefore, that in the 1949 epidemic of poliomyelitis in this country, cases of paralysis were occurring which were associated with the vaccination procedures carried out within the month preceding the recorded dates of the onset of illness, unquote. In 1951, the Los Angeles Mirror reported on the connection as well, stating that, quote, many more children under 5 years old develop polio within a month after vaccinations for whooping cough and diphtheria than non-vaccinated youngsters. A similar report was in 1959 in Time magazine, which explained, quote, researchers on their three continents have reported that when a child after recent vaccination contracts the paralyzing form of polio, the paralysis seems most likely to strike the injected arm or leg. For that reason, New York City Department of Health suspended the diphtheria and whooping cough inoculations of its 76 child health stations as of October 1st. A 1956 Lancet medical article had this to say, quote, from 1951 to 1953, 170 of 1,308 paralytic cases of polio in England and Wales were in children between 6 months and 2 years were causally related to the injection of diphtheria or pertussis prophylaxis, meaning vaccination, unquote. The article goes on to state that out of 355 polio cases that had a history of vaccination against diphtheria, whooping cough, and smallpox, 132, it's almost half, developed paralysis 1 to 28 days after vaccination. Both Dr. Salk and Sabin, the manufacturers or the developers of the polio vaccines, have been stated they were known to cause polio. It may surprise some to learn that Salk has admitted to this fact, even in testimony before Congress. Alan Phillips, vaccine researcher, says, quote, Jonas Salk, inventor of the IPV, testified before a Senate committee in January of 1976 that nearly all polio outbreaks since 1961 were caused by the oral polio vaccine. At a workshop on polio vaccines sponsored by the Institute of Medicine and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Samuel Katz of Duke University cited the estimate of 10 annual U.S. cases of vaccine-associated paralytic polio in people who had taken the oral polio vaccine in the four-year absence of wild polio from the Western Hemisphere. Jessica Scher of the National Rehabilitation Hospital Research Center in Washington, D.C. pointed out that most parents are unaware that polio vaccination in this country entails, quote, a small number of human sacrifices each year. Compounding this contradiction are low adverse event reporting in the National Vaccine Information Center's experiences with confirming and correcting misdiagnosis of vaccine reactions, which suggests that the actual number of vaccine sacrifices, meaning deaths, may be many times higher than the number cited by the CDC, unquote. A 1994 report by the Institute of Medicine concluded that there was compelling evidence that the live oral polio vaccine can produce paralytic and non-paralytic polio. Dr. Larry Schoenberger, a virologist with the CDC, agrees and says that polio caused by the vaccine has become more common than the natural virus. Now think of that. More people are going to get polio from the vaccine than would have gotten polio in natural occurrences. So the treatment for prevention is worse than the disease. In a 1986 panel concerning the use of vaccines in veterinary medicine, Dr. Salk himself stated, quote, in the developing countries, live virus vaccines often fail because they don't always protect those who are directly vaccinated due to inhibitors in the intestinal tract. In the United States, vaccine virus is the principal cause of continuing polio. Again, in the United States, vaccine of the virus, poliovirus, is the principal cause of continuing polio, unquote. Waylene James, vaccine advocate, believes that since doctors do not expect to find polio in vaccinated children, they are giving new names to old symptoms. She refers to an article that appeared in Science on July 5, 1991, called the China Syndrome. Quote, in China and in Latin America, there was a significant amount of paralytic syndrome between 1987 and 1990. There were 7,000 in Latin America alone. The article says, these new syndromes are like polio in that they attack the motor neurons of the spinal cord and prevent it from generating nerve impulses. But it can't be polio because the children who get it have already been vaccinated against polio. Researchers speculate that it might be a brand new disease. They call it medical virgin territory and are now going to work on developing a vaccine for this new kind of motor paralysis, unquote. Could you imagine the assumption, an arrogant assumption, this absolutely conceited assumption is, if you've been vaccinated against something, you certainly are not going to come down with this illness. So now I've shown you in the first 10 programs in this series, or 9 programs in this series up to this point, that there are many, many, many instances where people come down with the very condition they're vaccinated for. So what are they going to do? They're going to deny that it is the vaccine causing a problem and then try to create another vaccine for the symptoms. The introduction of the polio vaccine in the Philippines produced the country's worst epidemic of polio, resulting in the deaths of over 50,000 people. And as Cornier has documented, the U.S. is not without its share of polio vaccine mishaps either. Quote, from the year before the vaccine, 1954, to the year after mass vaccination, 1955, cities and states all over the country reported increases in cases of polio. Washington, D.C., 25%, Maryland, 41%, New York, 63% increase, Maine, 72%, Wisconsin, 83%, Connecticut, 92% increase, New Hampshire, 239% increase, Vermont, 267% increase, Rhode Island, 455% increase, and Boston, 642% increase in polio. That was the year after complete vaccination. In his book, Immunization, Theory versus Reality, Neil Miller says, quote, in 1956, soon after the Salk vaccine, polio vaccine was introduced, officials decided to determine how safe and effective it really was. Mind you, this is after they'd already inoculated everyone. The results of the study, the now infamous Francis Field trials, would help determine the feasibility of continuing to vaccinate millions of young children. What they discovered would have stopped most ethical people from continuing. Large numbers of children were contracting polio after receiving the vaccine. Clearly, the vaccine was neither safe nor effective. Instead of removing the vaccine from the market, however, officials decided to exclude from the statistics all cases of polio that occurred within 30 days after vaccination on the pretext that such cases were pre-existing, unquote. Like many researchers questioning the efficacy of vaccines in general, Vera Scribner has also spent a great deal of time studying the historical data on the various global polio campaigns in particular. She writes, quote, vaccination trials with poliovirus vaccines based on monkey neuron tissues were carried out in the 1930s. The trials were condemned because of marked side effects and fatal cases associated with administration of these vaccines. However, the work resumed some 20 years later and resulted in the production of the Salk poliovalent vaccine. A large trial with the Salk vaccine was organized by the Poliomyelitis Vaccine Evaluation Center at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Some doctors objected to the fact that the vaccines contained dead monkey kidney tissue. However, nobody did anything about it. In this trial, over 1,000 children were injected with three doses of the Salk vaccine between May 1st and December 1st, 1954. 129 cases of poliomyelitis occurred during the trial, including 3 weeks after the third injection, 90 cases in the vaccinated group and 39 in the placebo controls. However, because the 90 cases occurred during the vaccine period between May 1st and 2 weeks after the third injection, they were simply excluded from calculations. Of 749,236 placebo-controlled children, 428 developed poliomyelitis. Of 1,080,000 vaccinated children, 585 developed polio. The corrected figures are 428 plus 39, which is 467 in the placebo group, but 675 in the inoculated group. The authors of the report stated that there was 57 per 100,000 cases of polio among the vaccinated and 54 out of 100,000 among the unvaccinated. So the rate of polio was higher in the vaccinated group than in the unvaccinated group. When the complete figures are calculated, including the 90 which were excluded, the rate of cases of polio in the vaccinated group is even higher. Based, quote, based upon their own figures, the trial showed a total failure of the Salk polio vaccine to protect against polio. Despite this, in April of 1955, six pharmaceutical companies obtained licenses for production of inactivated poliovirus vaccines. Within 14 days of the release of the vaccine, a large number of babies and their parents and other contacts reported to have contracted polio from the vaccine. Encompassing a period of from April 25th to the end of June 1955 and described in detail in various scientific articles, quote, vaccination was halted for 2 weeks but resumed again in May. Polio epidemics continued occurring in the United States despite a high proportion of population being vaccinated. During a 1959 epidemic in Massachusetts, 77% of the paralytic cases had received all three or more doses of the vaccine. Hence, they were fully vaccinated. Similar disappointing results were reported from many other counties where the Salk vaccine was used on a large scale. Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Israel. The quality of the vaccine had been uneven and generally low. Not only from the vaccines in effect, not only were they ineffective, they continued causing paralytic poliomyelitis at the time when they were no epidemics of the wild virus. Vaccine critic Richard Neustadter reminds us to keep financial as well as public relations factors in mind. Quote, the cover-up of immune system failure following vaccination is reminiscent of the tobacco industry's continuous denial and misinformation campaign about the dangers of cigarettes. In both instances, huge profits are at stake in multi-billion-dollar industries. Vaccine manufacturers cannot afford to have their product maligned in a public forum, unquote. Neustadtler elaborates, quote, doctors have often stated that broadcasting adverse effects of vaccine to the public would hinder vaccine programs. This attitude emerged more than 30 years ago when Dr. Paul Meiser testified before a congressional committee concerning the polio vaccine campaign of the 1960s. It is hard to convince the public that something is good. Consequently, the best way to push forward a new program is to decide on what you think the best decision is and not question it thereafter. And further, not to raise questions about its danger to the public. The medical profession has been aware of the damaging effects of vaccines on the immune system since their introduction. For example, the ability of pertussis and DPT vaccines to stimulate the onset of paralytic polio was first noted in 1909. In every single polio epidemic since then, DPT injections have caused the onset of polio disease. In 1950, two careful studies were conducted in the state of New York to evaluate the reports of an association between the onset of paralytic polio and recent vaccination. The findings were published in the American Journal of Public Health. Investigators contacted the families of all children who contracted polio during that year, a total of 1,300 cases in New York City, 2,137 cases in the rest of New York State. A history of vaccinations received in the previous 2 months was obtained on each child and from a group of matched controls in the same population. These studies discovered that children with polio were twice as likely to have received the DPT vaccination in the 2 months preceding the onset of polio than were the control children. Quote, the association of vaccines with the onset of polio continues in the modern age. Unquote. During a recent polio epidemic in the Arabian Peninsula county of Oman, DPT vaccination again caused the onset of paralytic polio. In that epidemic, 70 children, 5 to 24 months, contracted polio during the period of 1988 to 89. The report in the British Medical Journal The Lancet confirmed that a significantly higher percentage of these children had received the DPT shot within 30 days of the onset of polio, compared to a control group of children without polio. 43% of polio victims compared to 29% of controls. The DPT vaccine suppresses the body's ability to fight off the polio virus, unquote. Now, let me, before we go forward, remind you that I'm Gary Nall, a special in-depth investigative report, simply looking at facts. No editorializing, no politicizing, just facts. We've been told time and again by journalists and scientists who report from those from the leading agency like the CDC that we need to vaccinate everyone. Now there's a big push to make sure everyone's vaccinated for everything, as if the vaccine's the answer. I'm merely presenting evidence that they have intentionally or by oversight failed to recognize that everyone getting polio today, everyone, is because of the vaccine. But they knew it at the time. And to make it convenient for themselves, if anyone was getting polio while they were giving the inoculations within months of it, they simply excluded that person in their statistics. That's like saying, okay, eat at my restaurant, and if you get food poisoning, you must get food poisoning within the next 10 minutes after eating it. Now, if you should wake up tomorrow with diarrhea and upset stomach, we're going to exclude you as having been considered getting it the night before my restaurant. You say, well, that's absurd. That is absurd, but no less absurd than when they have excluded cases of disease. And we're just now talking about polio. And now we've seen an association repeatedly in major medical publications based on very carefully done studies, including double-blind placebo-controlled studies, where large groups, the groups that got the DPT and then got the polio vaccine, were more likely to come down with polio. We also showed that it was one humongous public relations fraud. There was no protection against the wild polio virus from the inactive poliovirus vaccine. But let us continue on our journey here, giving you some additional facts. And it's not just here. I just report on what happened in Oman and published in the British Medical Journal. Most scientists looking at a vaccination's effects generally limit their study to extreme brief periods, 2 to 3 days. No symptoms appearing after that time are related to the vaccine. But Dr. Coulter, Harrison Coulter, author of DPT, A Shot in the Dark, asks a different and more difficult question. How do you determine what the long-term problems are? What happens to children who are slightly damaged by vaccinations who then grow up to be adolescents and adults? In his search for an answer, Coulter discovered studies that indirectly link vaccinations to violence and two other behavioral neurological problems. He first made the link while reviewing reports of vaccination-induced encephalitis. Encephalitis patients have been studied long-term, and he has therefore been able to make a connection between vaccinations and the symptoms exhibited in this population. Quote, "The way I did it was to begin with the assumption that vaccinations can cause encephalitis, a fact which is recognized and accepted by the medical profession and discussed in the literature. I hypothesized that the effects of vaccination-induced encephalitis could be similar to the effects of encephalitis from other causes. I did a fair bit of research into the literature on encephalitis from the 1930s, when there was a lot of encephalitis in the world. There was a huge amount of literature on the long-term effects of children who had encephalitis in childhood. I found, to my surprise, that the typical consequences of encephalitis were very high or very similar to the typical types of violent behavior and other unruly conduct which we note today in children and in adults. Hyperactivity, dyslexia, attentional disorder, tendency to epilepsy, tendency to autistic behavior, and finally, tendency towards impulsive behavior, and specifically impulsive violent behavior. Also, impulsive sexual violence falls in that category. Every one of these topics I have mentioned have been discussed in the literature from the 1930s and 40s on encephalitis. I said to myself, if that's the effect of encephalitis, it must certainly be the effect of encephalitis from vaccination as well. It seems unlikely that any special interest groups will ever find the studies necessary to prove Coulter's hypothesis. As he points out, quote, "A hypothesis remains a hypothesis until someone has proven it by doing the necessary studies. The chance that the National Institutes of Health will spend $20 million doing a study to prove whether or not my hypothesis is correct is very slender. So it's going to have to remain a hypothesis until someone proves it out. But I have found that an enormous amount of information from the literature in support of it," unquote. Dr. Coulter goes on to describe how encephalitis can cause a number of serious neurological dysfunctions. He says, when vaccinations cause encephalitis, the individual comes down with a high fever, 106 degrees. The fever is centered in the part of the brain above the spinal cord, the encephalon. This type of high temperature can produce several possible effects. One of them is that the nerves can lose their insulation. This myelin is a very dense, fatty substance which protects nerves, just as insulation protects electrical wire. When a child is subjected to this type of temperature, the myelin melts away from the nerves and can be found in the blood in higher than normal levels. This means that the nerves are now bare, like electrical wires without insulation. And without myelin, nerve impulses can jump from one nerve tissue to another. This can cause any number of problems, unquote. In his book, Vaccination, Social Violence, and Criminality, Coulter supports his case with very specific information. Quote, "The vaccinations programs was given a boost in 1965 when Congress passed the Immunization Assistance Act. In the following years, more and more states extended their vaccination programs and made them obligatory. 4 or 5 years thereafter, physicians encountered a whole new group of neurologically defective 4- and 5-year-olds. In 1986, National Health Interview Survey found that between 1969 and 81, the prevalence of activity-limiting chronic conditions in persons younger than 17 increased in an inexplicable 44%. And almost all the increase occurred between 1969 and 75. Now, most of these activity-limiting chronic conditions are readily seen to be associated with the post-encephalitic syndrome. Children with childhood respiratory diseases increased 44%, asthma 65%, deaths from asthma in children age 5 and older increase, mental nervous system disorders increase by 80%, personality and other non-psychotic mental disorders, including behavioral disorders, drug abuse, hyperactivity, went up 300%. And diseases of the eyes and ears, especially otitis media, 120%. Reporting cases of hearing loss in both ears, 129%, and the increase was virtually identical in high-income and low-income families. Excluding poverty is a major factor. Conditions not associated with vaccine damage, injuries, genitourinary tract disorders, diseases of the circulatory system, infective or parasitic diseases, and deformities remain stationary. They didn't increase. They didn't decrease during the same time. By 1980, the overall number of disabled children, many of course with multiple conditions, had doubled. Over 2 million children in the United States had some, quote, limitation of activity, up to 1 million in 1960, up from 1 million. In percentage terms, 2% of children had some limitation in the early 60s, 4% in 1981. 1% had severe handicap in 1960, 2% in 1981. But both figures have continued to rise. In 1985, the rate for all degrees of limitation was over 5%, and severe handicap, almost 4%. As seems to be universal in every vaccine-associated condition, the authorities profess ignorance of the causes. The reasons for the increases are generally not well understood. But pediatricians pay tribute to this phenomena, calling it the new morbidity, defined as learning difficulties and school problems, behavioral disturbances, allergies, speech difficulties, visual problems, and the problems of adolescence in coping and adjusting, which are today the most common concerns of children. Unquote. So what you're diagnosing or calling attention deficit disorder, there's a high probability, based upon Calder's examination of the facts, this is merely one of the side effects of vaccination. Calder's not alone in his thinking. Cornier, for example, has noted that risk of meningitis following the Hib vaccine is 6.4 times, not percent, times. That's a 600% higher than is the risk of children not receiving the vaccine. Schreibner argues that, quote, cerebral palsy cases probably are equally insidious vaccine-related neurological problems. All countries with intensive or mandatory vaccines of infants experienced a 400% increase in the incidence of cerebral palsy in the last 50 years, not diagnosed at birth. According to Jamie Murphy, activist on the issue, quote, the serial passage of virus through animals or animal cells is necessary to reduce the virulence of the vaccine virus. It is one of the ways viral vaccines are attenuated or weakened for human use. However, the serial passage of virus can become fatal to the nervous tissue, non-virulent during animal passage, and has become so after being injected into man. During the 1940s, a catastrophe of this sort occurred in French West Africa during a large yellow fever immunization campaign. During the vaccine production, the yellow fever virus was propagated in mouse brain 258 times. The last two animal passages produced the sought-after strain. The laboratory mice that became paralyzed as a result were subsequently killed and their brains removed. In what sounds like a true horror story, the mouse brains were pulverized and then freeze-dried. The mouse brain yellow fever virus was used by the French to immunize thousands of West Africans in French West Africa in 1944. As a result, there were 102 reported cases of meningitis and encephalitis and 18 deaths among the vaccines. Citing research done by the U.S. Select Committee on Children, Youth, and Families, Merrill Dorey speaks of increasing numbers of children with developmental delays and autism and notes that developmental delayed children were 400% more likely than normal children to have been to have had a negative reaction to a vaccine. In 1998, Dr. Wakefield published an article in The Lancet describing the cases of 12 previously normal children who came down with diarrhea and abdominal pain, autism, disintegrative psychosis, and possible post-viral or vaccine encephalitis. 8 of the children diagnosed as autistic had received the MMR vaccine prior to developing the symptoms, and 5 of them had a history of adverse vaccine reactions. The number of, by the way, that was in The Lancet, the number of children diagnosed with autism is increasing at alarming rates. A report published by the California Health and Human Services Agency revealed a 273% jump in the number of children with autism over the last just 10 years. According to the California State Department of Developmental Services, in that state, in 1998, one in every 312 children was diagnosed as having autism. And this is a conservative estimate, since it does not take into account more than 13,550 children ages 0 to 3 who are served under the Early Start program and who in most cases are affected by speech and developmental disorders. The National Vaccine Information Center, together with the Autism Research Institute and Cure Autism Now and the Autism Autoimmunity Project, are calling for independent research on the role of vaccines in the development of autism. Parents are reporting to organizations in record numbers that their children are becoming autistic after vaccination. And the experience of just one group is that in the past 17 years, as immunization rates have increased significantly in all states, they've also seen an increase in reports of vaccine reactions, including immune system dysfunction and autistic behaviors. And Barbara Lowe Fisher is not alone in reporting this disturbing trend. Dr. Bernard Rimland, founder and director of the Autism Research Institute, remarks, "Our database includes thousands of cases of previously healthy children who began exhibiting autistic behavior soon after getting a routine vaccination." Victoria Iverson, founder and president of the Cure Autism Now Foundation, states further, "Approximately one-half of the hundreds of parents who call our office each month report that their healthy child, totally normal child, became autistic very shortly after vaccination." Ray Gallup, director of the Autism Autoimmunity Project, says, "We can't wait any longer to find out whether some children are at higher risk than others for developing autism following vaccination." Well, following publication of Dr. Wakefield's Lancet study exposing a link between MMR vaccination and autism, vaccine supporters launched a counterattack. And another Lancet article denying such a connection was released in June of 1999. However, the integrity of this study has been widely questioned. And according to a report published in the National Vaccine Information Center website, quote, "Parent child health advocacy groups in the United States and Britain are charging the public health officials and governments of both countries manipulated research data in June of 1999 in order to stifle further investigation into the association between the live virus for measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and the development of autism in some children. The parent groups are criticizing the conclusions of British government authors of a study published in June of 1999 in The Lancet and an accompanying statement written by U.S. government health officials who are claiming that the small study lays to rest the possibility of MMR vaccination as a cofactor in the development of autism in some children. The population-based case series analysis conducted in the Northeast Thames region of Britain revealed that the number of children diagnosed with typical and atypical autism had risen by 25% in Britain each year, that's per year, since the 1980s, after the MMR vaccine was introduced in that country, and also found a significant clustering of parent-identified behavioral changes in children within 6 months of MMR vaccination. Despite these findings, and the fact that the pre-selected medical records of only 498 children were included in the retrospective study. The study authors categorically state that, quote, our analysis do not support a causal relationship between MMR vaccine and autism. If such an association occurs, it is so rare, it cannot be identified in a large sample group, unquote. Nonsense. That shows you science at its worst. Look behind the scenes of that and you will see a money trail and you will see a political trail. If you're stating that you have a statistically significant number of individuals who were completely normal, got their vaccine, and now have autism, and you can categorize these by the symptoms and the time period between the vaccine and autism, then you state that this is not significant and you cannot find it. This happens, by the way, all the time now. All the time. And later on next week, I'll be doing a show about bad science. Who controls the publication of these articles? Who funds them? Whose authors write up the final results? You could have a study done at a university that actually shows something's bad for you, like sugar. But if then an article comes out saying, good news, sugar's good, you don't know who funded it. What if a candy company funded it? Then would you still think, oh, good? What if the candy company scientist who worked for the candy company and the PR firm were the only ones who were allowed to take that data, interpret it as they wanted to, and write the results as they wanted to? What if the scientists who were paid at a university to do the actual research had no say-so in the final write-up of the article? Happens all the time, every day, many times a day. Industry protects itself. Ethics are what is not being looked at behind the scenes. And the allergy-induced autism, the largest and most influential parent advocacy group representing autistic children in Britain, labeled the study, quote, flatly flawed and statistically inadequate, and called for the resignation of key members of the government study group and an independent study to be conducted. Rosemary Kessick, president, said the authors manipulated the results to so-called prove their own pre-existing hypothesis. They are prepared to place a skewed and feeble study into the public arena in an attempt to defend the MMR vaccination. We consider that any such attempt to justify health policy by using inadequate research as propaganda is reprehensible, unquote. And Barbara Lowe Fisher here in the United States says, quote, there's an inherent conflict of interest when the same government officials promoting mandatory vaccine are also used to investigate vaccine-associated health problems. Without an oversight mechanism in place, the public and Congress can be misled by data primarily controlled and generated by government health officials anxious to defend their existing policies, unquote. Barbara Lowe Fisher is co-founder and president of the National Vaccine Information Center in Vienna, Virginia. And for over a decade, she has been a consumer activist advocating the right of individuals to make informed, independent vaccination decisions for themselves and their children. And she shares her concerns about a number of these issues. We have time to take also a look at the pertussis vaccine. If there's one vaccine that's been the most problematic and caused the most controversy, it is the pertussis vaccine. After studying the issue in depth, I would suggest that you very carefully consider the evidence that would challenge its usage. In 1985, quote, our organization made a presentation at the Center for Disease Control. We questioned the health departments of eight states as to the vaccine status of children who had come down with a whooping cough in 1984 and discovered that over 60% had been fully vaccinated. So there is a real question of efficacy with the pertussis vaccine, unquote. As to why the public is kept in the dark about this situation, she speculates, quote, this is Barbara Lowe Fisher, I think they are afraid to tell the truth because people will ask questions and perhaps choose not to vaccinate, unquote. Barbara Lowe Fisher and Dr. Harrison Coulter wrote DPT is Shot in the Dark, which examines the dangers of pertussis vaccine. Fisher says, quote, during the 2.5 years of research that went into writing that book, I interviewed literally hundreds of parents across the country. I listened to them tell me the same story again and again of how they took their healthy, beautiful babies into the doctor's office for a routine TPT vaccine and then watch their baby scream and twitch and lapse into shock and die. Often those deaths were written off as sudden infant death syndrome. They still are. Other babies are being left with learning disabilities or hyperactivity. My son was. Some children withdraw into autism or become mentally retarded and rack with uncontrollable convulsions. I wanted this book to be a voice for those parents and children. I kept hoping that once the book came out and people knew the truth, that something good would happen. I believe that the health officials at the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics, who are in charge of our country's vaccination systems, would change their policies and conduct studies to identify high-risk children and screen them out of the program. I believed they would conduct studies to determine whether vaccines were causing long-term damage to our children's immune and neurological systems, and I thought they would institute policy changes so that fewer children would be vaccinated and damaged. It was the greatest disappointment of my life that this did not happen. Unquote. Fisher points out that at one time, the medical literature was filled with studies documenting the ability of the pertussis vaccine to cause brain damage and death, both in lab animals and humans. Quote, there were detailed descriptions of what was known as classic pertussis vaccine reaction. But by the end of the 1980s, you couldn't find one scientific article examining vaccine side effects. And by the early 90s, health officials at the CDC and the AAP were denying that pertussis vaccine had any permanent side effects whatsoever. They were telling doctors and parents alike that babies exhibiting symptoms of a classical pertussis vaccine reaction were destined to die or be brain damaged, and ignoring the fact that a vaccine had been given on that day. It was absolutely unbelievable when you take a step back and look at what they have done. They say the vaccine is not to blame when 6 years of medical research says otherwise. In my opinion, this is nothing more than a deliberate cover-up by health officials who are practicing bad science and bad medicine. Children are being killed or brain damaged every day in this country because doctors and PhDs in charge of the disease control system in this country can't bite the bullet and admit that they have problems with vaccines. They can't tell the truth, and they are refusing to take action to solve these problems. What has to be done now? Many would agree with Fisher when she says, quote, there needs to be a thorough investigation into whether mass vaccination is the way to go in terms of disease prevention. As Fisher reminds us, science is still just assuming that mass vaccination is an unquestionably good thing for society. No one is examining the downside, the possibility that in the long term, vaccinations can result in catastrophes down the road. This is a major public health concern. By law, every child born must be vaccinated, yet no one is looking into it, unquote. That brings up the end of our program for today. This is part 10 of Vaccines, a Second Opinion. I'm Gary Null. More to come on this. If you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346. 888-317-2346. Program number 2672. Have a good day, everyone.